Welcome to the Hackberry House of Chosun. I'm Bob. I'm reading today from a book entitled The Christian in Complete Armor by William Gurnall. He was the English Bible scholar and pastor who died in 1679. Today, the excellency of the power of holiness. Number one, it appears only in man. Inferior creatures have a certain goodness proper to them. But only intellectual beings are capable of inward holiness. And if we give up our crown of holiness, we become worse than beasts themselves. Indeed, it is righteousness which makes one man differ from another, in God's eye. All men stand on level ground before God until holiness is added. Earthly kings have the power and prerogative to assess the just value of every coin, and how much every penny is worth. Surely then the sovereign God has even more right to say, the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor, or the tongue of the just is as choice silver, and the heart of the wicked is little worth. Proverbs 12:26 and 10:20. Number two, it furnishes evidence for heaven. Follow peace and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Hebrews 12:14. Before Enoch was translated to heaven, he walked the earth with God as a holy man. And this is why God wanted him in heaven with him, for heaven is a city where righteousness dwells. Can we actually expect to get there when we do not care about keeping our behavior holy, or about exercising righteous acts of godliness? Certainly, what God has written about holiness will stand. He shall never blot out or revise his word for anybody. So we must either renounce our hope of going to heaven, or resolve to walk in the only path that will lead us there. It is vain breath which does not set the sail of our affections and the movement of our feet in the direction of our desired destination. Number three, it empowers us for communion with God. Communion with God is so wonderful that many pretend to have it when they do not even know what it is. It is like the man who brags about knowing the king, but never has seen his face nor met him. God's Spirit calls it a lie when a man says he knows the Lord, but entertains unrighteousness too. 1 John 1:6, if we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie. Communion is rooted in union, and union in likeness. Can two walk together except they be agreed? Amos 3:3. There is a big difference between communion with God and communion with God and familiarity with ordinances. A man may live with ordinances every day, but still be a stranger to God. Not everyone who walks around in the palace talks with the prince. Ordinances are a kind of exchange where holy saints trade with God by his Spirit for heavenly treasures, an enriched filling of grace and comfort. But because an unholy heart has nothing to trade with God, the Father will not communicate his pure grace to him. Even the holy person, under the power of a temptation, is unfit to have communion with God until he overcomes the sin. Solomon explained it like this: a righteous man falling down before the wicked is as a troubled fountain and a corrupt spring. Proverbs 25:26. How much more true when a saint falls before the wicked and yields to temptation, his spirit clouded with impurity. If we know better than to drink from a troubled spring, though wholesome in itself, but wait until it settles and becomes clear again, how can we expect God to taste communion with a godly person before his stream runs clear with repentance for sin? Number four, it provides peace. I do not say that peace is founded on our holiness or righteousness, but it is supported and attended by these. There is no peace, saith the Lord, unto the wicked, Isaiah 48:22. We could as easily force the sea to stay always still as we could make the unholy heart quiet. Wars inside a man's heart are started by his own lusts and make him feel torn in two. These break the peace and keep the man in continual tempest. Yet if the Spirit of holiness comes and Christ's scepter of righteousness takes sweet control over the life, this storm is calmed more and more. The unholy ways of unrighteous men, however, walk around in their thoughts as John's ghost troubled Herod. While both asleep and awake, they have the terrors and scent of hellfire all about them. This restlessness makes men discontented in every situation. They cannot enjoy the sweetest pleasures, nor bear the bitter taste of afflictions. Of course, there are ways to deaden the conscience and bind up the feelings of an unholy heart temporarily, but the strength of this opium soon wears off, and the horror returns with an even more severe attack. Let me share an example. A notorious drunkard shook off the warnings which Christians had tried to fasten onto his conscience as easily as Paul dropped the viper from his hand. Instead of surrendering to God, he forged ahead into more sin, fortifying his mind with the presumptuous hope of God's mercy in Christ. After a few years, though, the man got sick, and when his companions visited, he was so cheerful and confident in God's mercy that his false hopes motivated them to indulge in lusts even more. And yet just before death came the old sinner's guilty conscience was fully awakened, and the poor man roasted in the scorching flames of his former ungodly practices. And as he died, he screamed in despair, "I had prepared a plaster and thought everything was all right, but now it will not stick any longer." His condemned conscience tore his hope away as fast as his trembling hands could put it on. This is true, my friends. The blood of Christ himself will not cleave to an unrepentant soul which holds any sin in his heart. God will pluck up men from the altar who run to it, but not from their unrighteousness. Then he will slay them in sight of the sanctuary which they had so boldly trusted in. You know the message of Solomon to Adonijah. If he will show himself a worthy man, there shall not a hair of him fall. But if wickedness shall be found in him, he shall die. 1 Kings 1:52. It is futile for a man to think he can hide under Christ's wing from the cry of his accusing conscience if wickedness is taking sanctuary in him. God never intended to secure us in unrighteousness, but to save us from it. 5, it has a strong influence on others. When this power of holiness works in the lives of Christians, it mightily affects the spirits of men. It stops the mouths of the ungodly, who are ready to reproach religion and to throw the dirt of a saint's sin in the face of every profession of faith they hear. It is said that frogs stop croaking when light is brought near them. And the light of a holy life serves as a padlock on profane lips and forces the sinner to acknowledge God in the saint. 5:16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Not only does the power of holiness shut their mouths, but it opens their hearts to embrace Christ and his grace. One reason so many souls came into the gospel net in early times was that the divinity of the gospel doctrine was evident in the holiness of Christians' lives. Justin Martyr, for instance, writing of his own conversion, said, "The holiness which shined in Christians' lives and the patience that triumphed over their enemies' cruelty at their deaths made me conclude the doctrine of the gospel was truth. Even Julian, as far from the kingdom as he was, reported that Christianity was growing because Christians were a people who did good to all and hurt no one." Yet in these times, when scandal spatters the robes of righteousness in the Christian religion, it is harder to get those outside to come under the net of the gospel. There are some animals which, when they as much as breathe on the grass, will by that keep others from feeding in that pasture for some time. And sadly, until the bad reputation of pride, dissension, error, and carelessness has worn off, there's not much hope of crowds of converts flowing into Christianity. The minister cannot preach day and night. He may spend 2 or 3 hours a week in the pulpit, holding the mirror of the gospel before the faces of his congregation. But the lives of Christians preach all week long. If they were holy, they would serve as a repetition of the minister's sermon to families in the world and would keep the gospel's sound continually ringing in their ears. Nobody enjoys talking to a person who has bad breath. And that's the way we often think of the person who speaks to us in reproof. And thus, Christians need a sweet-scented life when they must reprove and give counsel. Reproofs are good, strong medicine, but it is hard for a person not to vomit them up in the face of him who gives them. Now, nothing is more effective to keep a reproof from being spit out than the holiness of the one who reproves. "Let the righteous smite me," said David. "It shall be a kindness. Let him reprove me. It shall be an excellent oil which shall not break my head," Psalm 141:5. Reproof can be more easily received from such a hand because of the authority that accompanies holiness. No one but a hardened sinner will fight back at the righteous man who is given reproof softly, like oil gently rubbed into an infection, with compassion and love to the hurting person. Thus it is easy to see how influential the power of holiness would be in the life of the wicked man. And it is no less effective upon Christian brothers and sisters. When a Christian sees a holiness sparkle in the life of another believer, the grace within him springs up as the baby in Elizabeth leaped at the sound of Mary's voice. Truly, one holy man is enough to put life into a whole society. And on the contrary, the looseness of a single professing Christian endangers the entire group of people who know him. Therefore, God has given us a strict charge: follow peace with all men and holiness, looking diligently lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. That's in Hebrews 12:14-15. A scab on the wolf's back is not dangerous to the sheep, because they cannot easily be lured to spend time with him. But if the sore spreads into the flock, among Christians who feed, pray, hear, talk, and walk in fellowship together, then there is a great deal of fear and danger that it might spread. Thus a careless Christian helps the devil with more efficiency than whole troops who never profess to believe. In fact, Satan had a whole fistful of sins and errors that he did not know what to do with, until he found a way to hire unholy professors of the faith as his brokers to recommend and dispense them to others. In a word, the man who will not keep up the power of holiness in his life in some measure makes himself useless to Christ. Do you want to pray for others? A heathen could tell an evil man to hold his peace and not let the gods know he was aboard the ship when a storm swept in. Is it comfort you want to speak to a grieving person, counsel to a friend? They will think you are only joking until your commendation of holiness is joined by holiness in your own life, and that is to say, until you commend it to yourself. Number 6. Holiness and righteousness are the pillars of nations. Righteous men are the only ones who keep a nation's roof from falling in on its people's head. The presence of 10 righteous men could have prevented the fire and brimstone which consumed Sodom and entombed her people in their own ashes. Indeed, that judgment was delayed and the destroying angel's hands tied as long as the righteous man Lot was among them. Remember Genesis 19:22, "Haste, escape, I cannot do anything until you become thither." God records other examples of unrighteousness and righteousness turning the tide of history. Rehoboam and his kingdom were strengthened for 3 years, might have been for 20 more, if his unrighteousness had not pulled it down upon himself and his people. For this downfall is dated from the very day he walked away from God, 2 Chronicles 11:12. On the other hand, when Josiah came to the crown, he found Judah crumbling to pieces. Yet because his heart was turned to God and prepared to walk before God, God accepted Josiah's plea for a people under arrest and at the prison door. Their safety was linked to the ruler's life, for soon after Josiah died, the nation tumbled into ruin again. When Martin Luther foresaw the black cloud of God's judgment coming toward Germany, he told friends that he would do his best to keep it from falling in his lifetime, and he believed that it would not. But he concluded, "When I am gone, let them that come after me look to it." The power of holiness has deteriorated among us compared to what it was a generation ago. Christianity runs unclean and full of dregs, murky and unholy among professing believers in Christ, and we know God will not put up with it much longer. If Egypt knows a drought is coming by the low ebbing of the Nile, surely we can see judgment hovering by the fall of the power of godliness. We hear many people mourning for what they have lost, some for the lives of friends in war, others for their wealth and possessions. But the group who must claim first place among mourners are churchgoers who have lost their first love. Thorough decay has set in because they have forfeited their compassion for Christ, His truth, worship, fellow servants, and their holy walk before God and man. We are a people redeemed from countless dangers and deaths. It is a poor time for a rescued man to start stealing and cheating again, as soon as the rope is cut from his neck. Surely it added to Noah's sin to be drunk almost as soon as he had safely landed on shore, after he had seen the whole earth sinking before his eyes. Here was the one righteous man God had left to plant his world again with a godly seed. The earth has hardly yet drunk in the rivers of blood which have been shed in our land, speaking of England. And the towns are still digging out of the debris which the miseries of war piled on them. The sounds of grieving widows and orphans, whom the sword bereaved, are not yet stilled by their own deaths. Once we were terrified to see this nation, like a candle lighted at both ends, burning every day, with the flames coming nearer and nearer us. Yet now the people who claim Christ's name are forgetful and are still turning away from God to prefer pride and lust. What right do we have to celebrate our peace when the result of our deliverance is that we presume to commit worse abominations? This is like one whose malaria has gone, but its after effects leave him in poorer health than the disease itself did. Surely our God laments to look at the exchange, to have war, pestilence, and famine removed, and to be left swollen up with selfishness, error, and defiant, godless behavior. Again, we are a people who have made more pretensions to righteousness and holiness than our forefathers ever did. Or what did all the prayers to God and petitions to man mean? We put ourselves under a covenant for personal reformation and then another for national reformation. These intentions echoed such a loud report in foreign nations that our neighbor churches wondered how these glorious beginnings might ripen. But now, after putting forth leaves, and thereby telling God and man to expect fruit from us, our barren condition brings us nearer to a curse than ever before for disappointing the just expectations of both. Nothing can save the life of a nation or lengthen peace through mercy to it except the recovery of the much decayed power of holiness. This surge of righteousness would be as a spring of new blood to a dying body, reviving it and bringing many more happy days, more than it has ever seen before. Yet we are degenerating from bad to worse, wasting in lingering death. Each day our breath gets shorter and shallower. If the sword should be drawn among us, would we really have enough strength to survive? Interesting question, don't you think? As I speak today in 21st century America, going through the same processes. Thank you for listening, and I do like hearing from you. Remember, send me a note every once in a while, bob.j.faulkner.72@gmail.com. And while you're here, I think you'll find some other things on the site that will be a blessing to you. Do check it out. This is the Hackberry House of Chosun, and Lord willing, we'll talk again real soon. Bye-bye.